This is the First Time Podcast.
It's us talking writing and publishing.
Welcome to our Masters series,
where we interview Australian and international authors at the top of their games.
I'm Kate Mildenhall.
And I'm Catherine Collette. Welcome to the First Time Podcast.
Masters series.
This interview is with Gabrielle Wong. She is an award-winning author and illustrator of more than 20 novels and picture books for children and young adults. Gabrielle's latest book is Zadie Ma and the Dog Who Chased the Moon. She also wrote Ting Ting, The Ghost Hunter and A Ghost in My Suitcase. Highly recommend those two if you have 8 to 12-year-olds. She also wrote Poppy and Pearly from the very beloved Our Australian Girls series. You might have heard of those. Gabrielle was born in Melbourne of Chinese heritage. As a result, her books are a blend of both Australian and Chinese culture with a touch of fantasy. In March 2022, Gabrielle was named the Australian Children's Laureate for 2022 and 2023. I cannot think of a better author, writer, person to be in that role. I love this chat with her. We talk about rejection, how books can help fight racism, and about magical experiences in life. Welcome, Gabrielle, to the First Time Podcast.
Well, thank you for having me. It's lovely being here, Catherine.
Now, we're going to start at the very beginning. Nowadays, you are both a writer and an illustrator. Which came first, writing or drawing?
Drawing came first. All the way through school, since I was little, I have been drawing, and I wanted to be an artist when I left school or when I grew up. And the writing, I was not a good student at school. I wasn't academic. I wasn't interested in academic work. I loved art. I loved sport. And so it was a real surprise to me that I am an author writing novels now. Because I didn't discover this until much, much, much later, which we'll probably get to later on because we have to fast forward otherwise.
I suspect so. Yeah. Although you didn't write, were stories and storytelling part of your life?
Absolutely. In my imagination. And when I was young, I had a best friend. Well, she's still my best friend. We have known each other since we were 4 years old. And we would just make up stories and act them out. And, we'd read books like Secret Seven and, you know, go looking for adventures and things like that. So I think I had the imagination to create the stories, and Wendy had the bravery to go and, you know, sneak into the witch's mansion and things like that. So, you know, we acted out a lot of the stories that we had made up. In the days where, you know, one was free to roam around when, you know, one is like 6 years old, not having to be closeted and fenced in like today's kids are, unfortunately.
Mm. Mm. So, Gabrielle, you told stories, but you didn't start out writing until much later. How did that change?
Well, as I said before, I was really not a good school student. And I failed year 12 and I had to repeat it because I wanted to go to RMIT to study graphic design.
You know, this is such a good story for people to hear because so often we hear I'm very much appreciating everything that you're saying. I think it's
I mean, there's so many authors who go, oh, I've been wanting to write since I was a kid. And I know a lot of authors are so clever academically, you know, they're lawyers and, you know, they studied this and that. And for me, no. So it was such a total surprise because it wasn't until my children, I did want to write a picture book because picture books, of course, come from, for me, from illustration. And later on we can cover the woes of trying to write a picture book. But it wasn't until my children were like 8 and 10 years old that I had a dream one night, a really profound prophetic dream. And as I said, I had never written anything before. Oh, I had written angst-ridden poetry when a boyfriend dumped me in year 9. But, you know, like everybody. But apart from that, I hadn't written anything. And if anybody looked at my diaries when I was young, I would be so embarrassed, you know. I went to the beach. I played in the sand. I went swimming. I met my best friend, you know, like really so unimaginable.
So did you keep a diary?
When I was little, I've still got it, a five-year diary. It's got like, it's got, you know, have you ever seen a five-year diary? And it's got a little lock on it, so you could lock it with a tiny little key. And so you've got, you know, the 1 year, and you can write in like five lines. And then the second year, third year, fourth year, fifth year. So how much can you fit in a tiny little diary like
that's
that?
That's perfect.
It's so unimaginative what I was writing. So I was not a writer when I was a child. But I guess, you know, I really think that things are brewing away in the background. And until something brings it out, a lot of my books are about hidden potential. And unless something activates that potential, then it's going to be in the background all your life. And luckily for me, there was a stage when my children were like 8 and 10, as I was saying, that I had a feeling that I was going, and I'd forgotten about writing picture books, that dream of writing picture books. I thought that I was going to invent something, like something special, like post-it notes or something really cool like that. And so every night, and I would really, I have this feeling that this train was coming towards me, and I was the station, and it was coming towards me, and it was getting closer and closer, and it was quite exciting. But I only had that feeling that there was something at the end that I was going to discover, and I was waiting for it. So every night I'd think about it, and then I would think, well, maybe in the morning I would have discovered this, you know, this great creation. Well, lo and behold, I had this dream one night, and it was such a prophetic dream that the next morning I wrote it down. And that, by writing the story down, that became the premise to my first novel, The Garden of Eva's Cassia. But if you want to hear the dream, I can tell you the dream. Because
I do.
Yes, all right. Well, I have to go right back to when I was a child and how it was growing up in a very white, racist Australia. And it has been like that again. Anti-Asian racism has been like that since the gold rush. And there have been waves on it of it. And, of course, it came back during COVID in a big way. But it was like that when I was growing up, you know, I couldn't walk down the street without somebody winding down their car window. I mean, these are adults yelling at an eight-year-old walking down the street by herself, yelling out, saying, you know, well, I'm not going to repeat what they were saying, because it you know, saddens me to think that, you know, that you have people in the world who are like that. But so, of course, I was ashamed of being Chinese, and I felt so white inside because I grew up in a white suburb. I was the only Asian kid in my whole school, and we didn't speak any Chinese. We didn't know anything about Chinese culture in those days. Everybody wanted to fit in to the white, you know, default culture. And so when I had this dream, so in the dream, we used to live on top of a shop. My parents had a shop downstairs and we lived upstairs. And in the dream, I was walking down the narrow staircase of this shop. And on either side of the staircase were adults that I didn't know. They were just strangers. And as in dreams, and of course, in the narrow, in actual reality, there's no way adults could be lining this narrow staircase, but they were in the dream. And I was walking down the steep staircase of our shop, and I was probably about 8 years old, and they were patting me on the back as I was walking down, and they were saying, "Go out into the light, go out into the light," in that very, you know, like mystical fashion. And down below was the doorway of our shop, and there was bright light, bright sunlight outside, and there was a big procession going by. And so I walked down and I joined this procession, and we were all walking towards the sunlight. And then all of a sudden, this huge Chinese dragon raised its head, and I had this immediate feeling that I was, and we all were in this procession, part of the body of this dragon. And so then I woke up, and when I thought back about that dream, because it was such a revelatory dream, because people call, Chinese people call themselves people of the dragon. Chinese dragons are very significant. They bring rain. They are the emperor in the past, you know, was the dragon emperor sitting on the dragon throne. It has a great part to play in Chinese culture. And so by subconsciously or conscious, you know, whatever, bringing this into a dream, it was almost like your conscious, your subconscious is and bring into the consciousness that you are recognizing yourself as a Chinese, you know, and as a Chinese Australian, and to be proud of it and not to, many years had gone by since then. I had gone to live in China and Taiwan, and I had come to accept that having more than one culture was fantastic. Mm. But this dream was the beginning of my writing career, because the next day I wrote the dream down, because I think that dreams are very significant. And I feel that people who have dreams, like, you know, dreams that they think, I can't make sense of that. Why did that dream come about? Because I know that we all have those dreams. I mean, most of the dreams that we have are about our everyday lives, you know, things that have happened the previous day or what we are worried about. But sometimes they're very profound. And this dream was very brightly, vividly coloured. And I think those are very dreams to take note of, because that dream was telling me something. And I'm glad I wrote it down, because it turned into a short story. And by the end of the day, I had written this story about a girl called Bonnie who had a box of magical pastels. And she would draw this magical garden on the pavement outside the shop she lived in. And this girl was just like me. She lived on top of a shop. She hated being Chinese, but she loved to draw. And I didn't know, because I had no idea, I knew nothing about writing novels anyway. I'd done some things with writing for children, but I'd never done anything about writing. I'd never taken a writing course or anything like that. So I didn't even know what genre it was. I didn't know who the audience was. And so I put that short story away in my bottom drawer. But at the same time, I was still interested in writing a picture book and illustrating it. And so I did a subject at Holmes Glen at TAFE, writing an editing subject, not the whole editing course, but just one subject, taken by Hazel Edwards, who wrote There's a Hippopotamus on My Roof Eating Cake, that iconic.
Such a wonderful
picture book, yeah. And so the first semester was taken up, you know, finding out how to present a picture book to publishers and critiquing each other's work, you know, which is great. And then the second semester was, Hazel said, now we're going to write a junior fiction novel. And I thought, no way, I'm not a writer. I didn't come here. I said it to myself, not to Hazel. I didn't come here to learn about that. I've got what I wanted. So I thought, okay, I only paid for one subject, so that was fine. And then I went home and I thought, well, you know, life, we really need to be challenged. We need to challenge ourselves. Only by challenging ourselves and putting ourselves outside of our comfort zone can we grow. And so I took the, you know, the step of, I brought that story from the bottom drawer, that short story, and every week I brought in a chapter, because that's what we had to do. We had to write a chapter and we had to critique each other's chapters. And I was really scared, because all the other students were taking the course, you know, the writing and editing course, whereas I, you know, didn't really know anything about writing. But I thought, you know, and every week up until the end of the semester, I could see Hazel's eyebrows getting higher and higher and higher, like, oh, you know, oh, this is interesting. Oh, this is a good story. And so it encouraged me, and she, and I was encouraged by the other students, of course, because, you know, we give, you know, positive but critical feedback. And by the end of the year, I had written a whole novel, and Hazel said, this is good enough to be published. So, you know, that was an amazing thing, because Hazel is not the sort of person who gives praise lightly. So she sent me off to her agent, not sent me off, but recommended me to her agent. I got a rejection. recommended me to her publisher, I got a rejection. Recommended me to other publishers, I got all these rejections. And I think one of your questions is, what is your greatest failure? So if you wanted to go to that.
Yeah, do it. I think there's nothing better as writers to hear stories of failure and rejection from writers who have also had great success. I think it gives us real hope.
Yeah, I so believe in, you know, you have to do the hard yards, don't you, in order to, I mean, some authors and authors I'll talk about can send a book in and it's, you know, accepted and it wins awards and everything. But I think most of us have done that rite of passage where we send work out and we get rejections. And I still get rejections, you know, so so that's something that is good to tell.
So as you were sending that very first book out into the world, what, I mean, you had Hazel's sort of endorsement, which must have given you some courage, but it's difficult to keep going. What kept you going?
So probably Hazel. I think that it's, I was so lucky to have her as a mentor, you know, to encourage me to keep sending it out. Don't give up. It's good enough to be published. I mean, if Hazel said it was good enough to be published, then I knew there was something there. If it was just me, I would have given up. And like I did with my first picture book, which I sent off way a long time ago before I had children when I was living in Taiwan, and I got rejected. And then Penguin said, oh, look, we like your illustrations. Come in and show us your illustrations. But I didn't want to illustrate anybody else's picture book. I only wanted to do my own, which was probably a mistake, maybe, because I would have got in. No, I don't think so. I think
it worked out.
However, it worked. Yeah,
so.
I reckon that was my path. And so I'm glad I took that path. And so I think I got about 6 rejections. I sent it to all the publishers that I wanted to, you know, the ones that I wanted to have published my book. And then there was one publisher I hadn't sent it to because they were the biggest. And I thought they wouldn't want, you know, an unsolicited manuscript from a no-name author, illustrator. And of course it was Penguin. And Hazel happened to be sitting in a festival and she was sitting next to Julie Watts. And Julie Watts was the children's publisher at Penguin in those days. And Julie, so Hazel said, write to Julie. I've just spoken to her. And so I wrote to Julie and sent in my manuscript.
And was this by post? Were you sending it out by post?
Yeah. And then, you know, you always have to send in a self-addressed stamp envelope. And I mean, in the olden days, you don't send it by email. You sent those and you say, have to put in an envelope with your own address on it. And when you sent, when it came back with your handwriting on it, it's, you know, it's just so heartbreaking. Yeah. But what, you know, I would like to say to aspiring authors is that not everybody can connect to your story. And it so happened that Julie connected with my story. She saw something in it and she thought it was publishable, whereas none of the others did. So I think that that's a very important thing to remember. I mean, it's just like if you read a book and you go, oh, I love this book, and you give it to your best friend and they go, well, you know, it was so-so. So it's all personal. And I'm so glad that Julie Watts accepted that book because it, you know, won the Aurealis Award, was published in England, Korea and America and all over the place. So it was a very successful book that other people couldn't see. So this is the thing, keep sending it out.
So what was the time period between the dream and that feeling that sort of something was going to happen and the book being accepted, say, for publication?
Probably 6 months before I had the dream, I felt that something was going to happen, that this train was coming towards me. I had the dream in 1999. I took Hazel's course in 2000. So I wrote finished the novel in 2000, and in 2002 it was published. It was quite quick, actually.
Yeah.
Because I did all that rejection with all the other in-between time. So that was quite a quick turnaround when you think about it, especially with all the editing. I'd have to do a lot of editing. I love editors. I love editing. You know, I'm not precious at all about my words. I just love it when the editor comes on board.
Oh, I want to come back to that. Gabrielle, you sort of have mentioned, you've mentioned a lot of different things, but one is this growing up in a pretty white Australia and having a Chinese-Australian background. Elsewhere, you've said that your work is greatly influenced by your experiences growing up between two cultures. What is it about that experience that you want to capture?
I suppose I'd like to make my readership a young people. I'd like to, not that I do it consciously, but I hope that those who are from another background, cultural background, can appreciate that having more than one culture, more than the Australian culture, having more than one culture is so fantastic. It's such an enriching experience that you can draw from, because now I realise instead of rejecting my Chineseness, I can draw from my Chinese culture because I did study, you know, in China and Taiwan, and I can draw from my Australian culture and I can make the two things meet. And that's what I do in my novels. Plus the fact that, because most of my novels have a Chinese person as a main character, as the protagonist. And by doing that, then a person who's from another culture, you know, maybe a white person who has no experience about feeling how it feels to be different on the outside, how it feels to not fit in, can actually identify with that, because only through books can we get inside the head of a character. No other art form does it. I mean, that's so amazing that a few marks on a page and you can be totally immersed inside the head of that character and feel how they feel, see what they see, smell what they smell, you know, hear what they hear. Reading is such an amazing story. That's the power of story.
It creates empathy. It also introduces people to culture, doesn't it? To beliefs and ways of doing things.
Yeah.
Your books are often generally set in the real world, but have these wonderful elements of fantasy and the supernatural and ghosts. Where does your love of these things come from?
I just it happens all around me. That's my life. It's not that, I mean, other people might think, oh, it's a fantasy world or it's unreality. And what is reality anyway? That's what I'm always questioning, because my reality is what I see out of my eyes, which is totally different from what you see from out of your eyes. My world is this thing. It's a feeling I have that, you know, I don't know what is real, because what is real to me is not necessarily real to you. So a lot of magical things happen to me. Other people call them coincidences. I don't. I call them magical experiences. Ghostly experiences, yes. I know that dogs have a spirit. I experienced my dog's spirit after he died. She died, sorry. And I can vouch, in my world, dogs have spirits and souls. And in my world, you can write something. And, I mean, it's happened to me. I've written something. For example, I was writing a book called The Hidden Monastery, and I was doing research for The Hidden Monastery, and I didn't put this in the book, but it was about a boy who had this incredible smell, and he could smell the blowfly that landed in the hamburger when he walked past the hamburger joint. It was on the griddle, you know, cooking, but he didn't go. He just had this incredible smell, like a dog can smell. And so I was writing this little passage, this little chapter. And then when I got up and went to make the kids' dinner, or the family dinner, I thought, well, what am I going to make? Of course I'm going to make hamburgers. And, you know, I put in my egg and my spices and I'm stirring the meat around. And this is the middle of winter, and all of a sudden this huge blowfly, all the doors and windows are closed, commit suicide in my hamburger mince. And I had just written about that. You know, what are the chances of that? It's like, and I didn't imagine it. So there are a lot of, I have a lot of experiences like that, and I love it. And that's why I am definitely not a plotter. I let, you know, things happen from life come into my, when I'm writing, come into the novel or to the writing experience, because I don't want to cut myself off. I want to let it be totally organic. I mean, amazing things happen every day, actually, I find. If I could think of one today, I'm sure an amazing thing happened, but they happen all the time, so they become quite commonplace.
So with, say, if we take the example of ghosts, you've written a number of books that have ghosts within them. Do you think about whether children will find those things scary, or do you give them a frame that makes them not scary?
No.
Are those things that you think about, or?
No, I don't think about. I don't think about. yeah, I don't think about my reader at all. Okay. The only thing I think about, and that's probably from a general feeling, is that when I grew up, there was no book that featured a Chinese girl and who was the hero of the story. And so that's the only thing that I think about. But as far as writing, nowadays, nobody, Australian authors, children's authors, never write down to children, which is great. And I just write, the words I use are the words I use. They're not, I don't sort of go, okay, I can't use that word because the child won't understand it, or they'll have to ask what it means. If it's a, I mean, if they want to know what it means, they'll ask their parents, or they'll look it up in a dictionary, or they'll just gloss over it and maybe it'll come up in conversation and another time they'll hear it. So I don't ever think about those sort of things. And as far as ghosts are concerned, I loved ghost stories when I was a kid.
I loved them, and then I would be up for the whole night,
right.
Listening in terrified way to creaks and
that's right. that's humans. That's what we're like. Yeah.
So Gabrielle, we've touched on the fact that you not only write books, you often illustrate them as well. I want to understand how these things work together. When you start to write a book, where do you begin?
I begin with the setting. This is where you want to, I mean.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. I totally begin with the setting. I don't have the character in mind. I mean, the main character is always a part of me. All my characters are me, basically, in various scenarios, I guess. But I always start with the setting because having a very visual mind, I have to place my actors in a place that I can visualize. So if you asked me, see that chapter, it's set in da-da-da-da, can you tell me what's around that main character when they're acting that out? I can tell you exactly to the detail. I can tell you, and it's not that I am thinking about it, that I thought about it before, but if you ask me, I can think about it now. Yeah, there's a, you know, a mountain in the distance, a house with a palm tree. You know, I can tell you everything. So, you know, I'd love to write a movie and direct it, and because, you know, I feel as though I can visualize the whole thing. So I start with setting and then character. And all my characters are female, except for one, which is the Hidden Monastery. And I don't know why I made Jax a boy. I'm not sure why I did that. It was an unconscious thing. But all my other characters are girls. And I think I've done that probably on purpose because, just to empower the female in this world where, you know, we can feel unempowered or disempowered or whatever the word is. I just want to make girls strong and, you know, be able to stand up for themselves. And even if they feel bullied. I had this wonderful email just the other day from a girl she said she's 16 years old. But she wanted to write to me to tell me how much my books meant to her in primary school because she's a Chinese Australian girl who was bullied for her heritage. Now, you know, I don't know what city she she comes from. She comes from a city. She wasn't in a regional school. She was bullied for being Chinese. And you know, that sort of saddens me in a world, in today's world, where, you know, in my day, there were very few Asian families around. So maybe it was a, you know, common thing. I never got bullied at my school, but, you know, outside, yes. And she said that until her teacher librarian put my books in front of her, you know, she felt so under, you know, so not a person. And then when she'd read my books, it made her feel proud of being of her heritage. And then she sought out other ways of coping with being bullied. And she had amazing, because I liaised with her for quite a while, and she had amazing coping strategies. But that, you know, that is very, that's to hear that sort of thing from a girl, you know, who's 16 and she said she's gotten over it, which is fantastic. And I hope she has the bullying, because she had some terrible bullying at her school. But
what a profound impact to have.
Yeah.
You know, and I mean, you write stories that talk to hidden potential, and then you sort of managed to also bring it out in your reader. That's a very profound achievement.
Yeah, that's because, yeah, her email did bring tears to my eyes, because I thought, wow, you know, that's to have that. Well, I just bring it down to the power of story and the power of books. And just, I suppose, having an authentic voice, because all these things happened to me. And that's part of my thing with the Australian Children's Laureate, that I am encouraging children, librarians, parents, booksellers, to share books, diverse books about diverse characters by diverse authors with young people, because only by that, only in that way can we, you know, hopefully stem racism. You know, I mean, it'll be around for a long time in Australia, but, you know, hopefully it'll get better as more people are aware of or accept differences in all of us. So those, my themes keep reoccurring: diversity, acceptance, belonging. You know, that's a huge one, because until you feel that you belong to a society, you are always an outsider. You always feel like an outsider. So I have the setting, I have the character, and each book, every single novel I've written, is approached in a different way. And it's not that I say I'm going to approach it in this way, because, as I said, I'm totally organic. I bounce off things that are happening in the real world, in my real world. For example, with my latest book, Zadie Ma and the Dog Who Chased the Moon, it started off with the initial inspiration, which was my first dog, Rusty. But the writing process started off with these short fable-like stories. And I would go to so I wrote a lot of this book in my local cafe. And I would, so I've got a notebook with all these short stories in it. And I'd, on the way to the cafe, I didn't know what the short story was going to be that I was going to write in the cafe. I would look around me and I'd go, oh, there's a dandelion growing through a crack. I'm going to write about a dandelion. I had no idea what it was going to be about. And so I'd write about a dandelion, and I'd be thinking, well, what about my character? Sort of subconsciously, a little bit consciously, I'd be thinking about my character and what does my character need? And so I'd be thinking about the dandelion. And in this particular story that I wrote in the cafe, it's about a dandelion who doesn't know who she is. She knows that there's something going to come and lop her head off, which is the lawnmower, because she's a weed and nobody wants her and nobody loves her. And so, you know, she's just waiting, because everybody says this thing is going to come and chop your head off. And, you know, the magpie comes and tells her who she is, and a car whizzing by, and all these things tell her that this thing's threat is going to come. And she's going, you know, she's trying to hide her head. And it's called Dandelion, Dandelion, Hold Your Head High. And in the end, this little girl comes by, or the lawnmower is coming, and she can hear it rattling, brum, 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 brum. And she's going, oh no. And the grass that she's growing up in is saying, yay, you're going to have a haircut, you know, and they go, but she's saying, no, but you know, you're going to have your heads cut off. And they say, no, 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 it's just like a little tickle. It's lovely, lovely feeling. Look forward to it. And so the lawnmower is, you know, just mumbling, it stopped. And the little girl comes down, because what has happened overnight, the dandelion has gone to sleep and has woken up. And the little girl comes along and says, oh, look, I'm going to tell you the time, Daddy. Do you want to know? And so she plucks the dandelion. And of course, the dandelion has been changed into one of those lovely, whatever you call them, with the seeds. Yes. And she, you know, she blows at 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock. 4 o'clock, it's 4 o'clock, Daddy. And all the seeds of the dandelion go flying all over the city. And then one plants itself in the milk bar where Zadie lives and grows in a crack there. So it all ties back into the narrative of this, the main narrative, which is Zadie's story. And it was just, this is the magical experience that I'm talking about. I didn't know where these stories were going to go. Okay, so then I have the main, then I write the main story. And I used to write one chapter, or I'd write one paragraph, and I'd go back for my first novel, Garden Rivers Cassia. I'd write one chapter and go back and redo it and go back and redo it. And it was such a slow process. And, you know, I'd do that with a chapter and I'd keep rewriting it. And then I met an author who said that they could have been Ursula Dubosarsky, I'm not sure, but she said that she's tried, you know, she just writes a first draft, you know, what is it, the shitty first draft. And so I did that, and I wrote a shitty first draft, and I accept that it's a shitty first draft, and then I will go back over it. And so I'm doing that much, you know, learning to let go. And so it's, and then once I've done my first polished first draft, then I show, and I've done it, I've gone through it with my husband, who's my first editor, my kids, who are now, you know, in their 30s, and they have, since they've been little, they have been major influences in my editing process and helping me with the story. They've grown up with me sort of being a writer, and then I send it into the publisher, then I come back, they come back with a structural edit, and then I go and tear my hair out, because then I go, oh no, you know, I've made this tapestry, this tapestry that I think is perfect, and now they want me to unravel the whole thing and put it and weave it all again. And and for once, this is the first time for this novel, the Zadie Ma and the Dog Who Chased the Moon, I have not had to do a structural edit.
Oh.
Yeah, I know. And I was so surprised. I thought, oh, is it because now I'm Australian Children's Director? They think, and
yes,
I
was 24.
They think she doesn't need to be edited.
You're
anymore.
The boss now.
Yeah. And I thought, no, that doesn't give me a sense of security at all. But I guess it's worked, because I'm getting these great reviews, which is fantastic. So because unless you get reviews, you don't really know how your book stands. Mm. And so, and it's only been in the last 2 days, because it's only just come out. So I feel, okay, maybe I am getting better as a writer. and so the next process, so once I've done the edited, I mean, as I said, I love that stage where I'm working with an editor and we're working together to make the book the best it can possibly be. So I say to every, you know, author who is an aspiring author, once they get accepted and they get to the editing stage, don't be precious about your words, because, you know, your publisher and your editor wants it to be a good book too. And just, you know, do away with some of the ideas. I've had to kill off characters and get rid of them, you know, because the publisher, I mean, for this book, I definitely got rid of a character that I wanted to be in there. I had two storylines going. They told me to get rid of one storyline, and I did, and it made the book so much simpler, so much easier to resolve, and I'm so glad I took their advice. And then the very last thing I do is the illustrations, because I don't know until I've put the final words in what the illustrations are going to be and what illustrations are needed, because I feel that the illustrations are there to show the reader something, not to, like a picture book, not to explain. For example, in A Ghost in My Suitcase, there's a ghost hunting cupboard, you know, where the ghost hunting equipment is. Well, I've got an illustration of that just to show the reader what it looks like. Otherwise, if I just say there's a, you know, a Mingxian mirror in hanging up on the second shelf and a da-da-da-da, there's no, I mean, that yes, they can form pictures, and it's lovely to form pictures in your own minds. But having a picture there. And I realised too that there are some readers who can't visualise.
Mm.
And I've only just realised that. I've only just learned that. I thought that everybody could visualise. So having pictures there is also a good way to help readers. And when I was a child, I loved books with pictures in them, with illustrations in them, because I was such a bad reader. I mean, I was a very poor reader.
Well, even I see with my own kids, the Harry Potter books they've just released with illustrations, and it's a wonderful addition. As you Absolutely. Say, it does add a lot.
It does add a lot, and it helps those who find reading hard. Mm. So if I saw a whole page of text, I'd go, no, I don't want to read that book, when I was young.
Mm.
I mean, even now I get a tired mind when I see a whole page of text. So for me, being a poor reader, which sounds funny when I'm an author, I listen to audiobooks because it takes me forever to read a book. And so now with this Sadie Mann, The Dog Who Chased the Moon, there is a whole new process that I went through. And it was much later on that I thought, okay, I've got Zadie's narrative, third person, told from the point of view, third person, what is subjective,
mm-hmm.
told from the point of view of Zadie. I've got her stories, which intersperse throughout the novel, depending on what stage in her development, in her arc is happening. And I also thought, okay, because it's about a dog as well, and I thought, what if I do a graphic novel, do the graphic novel section from the point of view of Jupiter?
Oh, that's wonderful.
So, yeah, so, and it was a challenge because I've never done a graphic novel before, and so there are two big sections of graphic novel, and if it was me as a child, I would have loved that because it would have broken up the text. It would have, I'd be able to visualize it because I love pictures. And also, if it was me, I would be coloring. I've got black and white books with pictures in them that I've colored, hand colored in, because I love coloring. And kids could do that with my illustration. They can color them in or copy them, because that's what I did a lot.
Yeah.
To copy. Copying is a really good way to make yourself better at something. And so that was a really, you know, a breakthrough. And maybe, you know, if I do write another novel, I will definitely put a graphic novel element in it. And I had a fantastic suggestion last night from one of the librarians who said, why don't you do a graphic novel of all your, just make them graphic novels of all the novels that you've written? I mean, how, because the story's written, that would be, what a
They've done that with the Babysitters Club is one example
they?
Of they've made into graphic novels.
I see.
It's a great concept. Gabrielle, your latest book has just come out. I think you are more than 20 books so far. Has the way that you manage the process, I guess, practically but also emotionally, of the book coming out into the world changed over time?
No. It's exactly the same, and I think every author would say this. You're waiting for that first review. Actually, that's what I always do. I'm waiting for that first review, because your publisher and your editor is going to say, "Oh, this book's wonderful," you know. But they're on your side, so of course they're going to say that, and you know, your rallies are probably going to say that as well. But I haven't shown, nobody else has read basic. I mean, my children and my husband, they don't say, "Oh, that's fantastic." They just give me a great positive feedback on certain bits. But until the first reviews come out, I'm just as nervous as I was. In fact, I'm more nervous because when my first book came out, The Garden of Cassia, I had no expectations. I had no idea that it was going to be, win an award. I thought, oh, okay, it's won an award. Yeah, I thought, and I didn't realize how big a deal it was to be published overseas. Now I know it's a huge, big deal because I haven't had that many of my books published overseas. So yeah, I suppose people expect you as an established author to have a good book, for your books to be a certain standard. And you cannot, you don't know. You're so involved in your book, you have no idea what it's going to be like. And I thought maybe because there's a narrative, there's the short stories, and there's the graphic novel. I haven't seen a book like it before, and I thought maybe it detracts, maybe it draws the reader out of the story when they're reading the other bits. But I got a fantastic review that my publicist sent me today, which says the opposite, and I just love it, it brought tears to my eyes. That's how emotional a review can be. And of course, if it's a bad review, they're the ones that you remember for life. And
how do you manage your bad review? What do you
you'll always remember.
What's that? Yeah, you, I guess a bad review at some point is inevitable. Have you learned ways of coping with a bad review? Is the wound always fresh? Do you have advice for writers managing that?
No, I don't. I'm afraid the wound is just as fresh. Just like the wound is just as fresh if I hear a racist remark thrown at me. Because it's personal. We've spent, with this book, I spent 3 years writing it, and it's dedicated to my first doggo I had when I was like 9 years old. So this story has been with me for a very long time. And you spend your heart, you put your heart and soul in it, and it's like somebody criticizing your child because it is your baby. So reviewers are important, but I just think sometimes they have to be really careful.
They can be crushing.
It can be crushing. It really can.
Coming out of COVID earlier this year, you were made the Australian Children's Laureate. Can you tell us about the moment that you found out you had been awarded this? Did you have any idea it was coming?
Absolutely no idea at all. And in fact, I didn't have any. Yeah. When I was told a year before it was announced.
Right. Okay.
So I had to keep it in. It was embargoed for a whole year.
For a whole year.
Yes, which was so hard because I was dying to tell. I told my family, close family, and I told my publisher agent, and that's about all. And some close friends who weren't in the writing business, because I thought other children's authors probably would, might not be able to keep the secret. I told people who had known me for a long time and were totally not connected to any of the other people I knew in the children's writing business. And so when the CEO or the Bruce Ellis told me, he's the, I don't know what you call him, the head of the, I mean, the Australian Children's Laureate Foundation is the most amazing organisation because the majority of those people who work for it tirelessly do it voluntarily. And so Bruce is one of these people. And he wrote, he left a message on my phone. He said, oh, this is Bruce Ellis. I'm calling from the Australian Children's Laureate Foundation. Could you call me back? And I thought, oh, what have I done wrong? This is my first reaction. because the day before I had received a newsletter from the Australian Children's Laureate because I belong to their, I've subscribed to their newsletter, and it called for every year they have a fundraising period. And I gave them some money as I do every year. And I thought he was ringing to say, well, Gabrielle, you didn't actually give enough. Can you give a bit more? I really, that's how surprised.
Wow, so left field, very
totally
left field.
Left field. And if you'd asked me 2 years prior to that, because somebody did ask me as I was leaving Readings Bookshop, somebody said, do you know who the next Australian Children's Laureate will be? And this was the person before me. This was Ursula Dubosarski. So this was before her appointment, before her announcement. And I said, I have no idea. And the person said, it's not you, is it? And I said, you must be joking. And I was just so shocked. And I walked away saying to myself, what are they thinking? How could they possibly think it's me? And not only that, I was saying, said to myself, if anybody asked me, there's no way I could do that. Australian Children's Laureate, I have to talk in front of all those people. How can I do that? No way. So this is
something
about stepping up, you know, like putting yourself in a totally, in a position that you would never.
Hidden potential.
Hidden potential. It's absolutely hidden potential. And so after I spoke to Bruce and he told me, I said, look, I really have to think about it. And then he said, look, we'll meet in your local cafe. So we met in the local cafe. And that night, before we had that meeting, because I do a lot of my creative, well, lately, in the last year, 2 years, I've done a lot of my creative writing at 3 o'clock in the morning on my phone. God. I just put it in notes. And yeah, so I write in the dark and I just put it in my phone and I'm not half asleep when I wake up. It's all coherent. And so I had written, before that meeting, I had written basically my theme, which is imagine a story, what I was going to talk about, which is about diversity, about imagination, about drawing. I'd written it all out and I haven't basically deviated from those notes. I've still got those notes on my phone. I haven't deviated from that. It was almost like the 20 years that I've been writing, it's all been there and it's just been waiting for a platform. It sounds crazy, I know, that it's given me the opportunity to talk about the things that I have been talking about for 20 years, I guess. And
as you say or have sort of touched on, feel unfortunately even more important in the context of COVID and that rise, particularly in that early stages of anti-Asian sentiment. It feels sad that those themes continue to be as important as they are.
Mm-hmm. It is. But I'm not patting myself on the back, but to have, as Australian Children's Laureate, an Asian face, I think that shows something, doesn't it? I think, so me just being Asian, having an Asian face, it is a good thing.
Well, I guess it's also kids what children read, but it's also when we talk about diversity, there's a lot of controversy sometimes, but I think there's also a lot of consensus in that we want people from all backgrounds and all walks of life to write.
Yes, that's right, and to feel included. So when I go to a school, and I mean, I can sort of feel the Asian kids in the class that are settling in going, she's like me, you know, she looks like me, or she looks like my mum or my grandma, you know, whatever. It's like it's a validation of who they are. And I think that's great. And so when I'm talking about writing and kids writing themselves, I hopefully encourage children to do that, to become authors in their own right, although there's very little money in it. So I don't know whether Asian parents will want their children to be writers and illustrators. And, yeah.
Oh, I think you'll inspire a lot of kids, Gabrielle. We are on to the final question. We have a lot of writers that listen to this podcast. What is either the best writing advice you've ever been given or the worst?
Okay. Well, the best writing advice was by Hazel Edwards, when I was doing her writing class many, many, many moons ago, she said to us, and I've always remembered, every time I go through a bad period in my life, she said, every bad experience is research for a novel. And when you look at it that way, it sort of takes you out of the picture. doesn't it? It becomes
Wonderful. Sort of dwell in it a bit more in some
exactly,
ways.
Exactly. So, you know, you can sort of be in it because it's a bad experience, but be out of it. And so you can look at it both ways. And the other one, because I want to give you two, is also by Hazel Edwards that she told us in that writing class. And that is, she told us to write a contract to ourselves. Now, it was an amazing thing. She said, write something like, I, Gabrielle Wong, will have a novel accepted by blah, 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 and published by a certain date. And then put that thing away in a bottom drawer and forget about it. And lo and behold, that's exactly what happened to Garden of Biscassia, to the very month, I think.
Wow.
So it's like that, whatever that thing is called, where you
manifest.
Yes. So that's a magical thing, isn't it?
Yeah, I'm going to write all sorts of stuff down.
You can find the show notes for today's episode on our website, thefirsttimepodcast.com. Get in touch with us via Instagram or Twitter at @thefirsttimepod, or you can leave us a message on the website. Thanks for listening. You've been listening to The First Time Podcast. We record this podcast virtually on the unceded lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respects to elders, past and present, and we extend that to our First Nations guests and listeners. Sound production by Phoebe 80, who we can employ because of the wonderful support of our patrons via Patreon. Thank you so much for making this podcast possible.